Hello, friends. Welcome to this week's episode of the Empowered Together podcast and video show on incandescentwomen.com. It'll also be shown on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV, which is so much fun. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud founder of this organization, here today to talk with one of my favorite people, journalist, author, and activist, Natalie Jacobson. Welcome, Natalie.
Hi, everyone, and thank you so much, Hope, for having me on. It's a true honor, and it's like been wonderful meeting with you all the time and planning and taking on the world.
Absolutely. Well, the day after the election, Natalie was one of the most amazing women who we came together and we talked about this Empowered Together network, and it has grown since November. Here we are. It is May 9th when we're recording, and this podcast and video will be live soon. So let me tell you a little about this truly amazing woman before we jump into our Q&A. So as I said, Natalie is an award-winning journalist, writer, and marketer who diverts her time and talent to the nonprofit sector, inspiring others to take action and change the world. And that could not be more true of who she is. She has reported on civil rights in Virginia and defended journalist rights in court. One of her passions is filmmaking. She has shown 3 projects at film festivals. Of course, in her spare time, she can be found at cultural festivals, boarding planes, volunteering, and in greenhouses, as you can see by the spectacular array of plants behind her. Natalie is also the author of the 2024 book, Ghost Train, which is one of my favorite books. We'll both hold it up. Natalie says she grew up global-minded in an aviation family hailing from the Pacific Northwest. She spent her summers creatively writing in her backyard. After graduating from college, she lived in Japan for years as a magazine writer and photographer for TV stations, fostering the love of untold stories. And this book was born from some of those experiences. So first question, what was your first aha moment? When did you realize the path that you were setting out on?
So I've been all of these things, a communicator, like almost my whole life. It didn't really come together for me actually until recently, just how perfectly everything truly aligned, because my first moment of activism was when I was actually 8 years old. I had just witnessed on TV the effects of Hurricane Mitch, and how it devastated Central America and Latin America, the Caribbean. And I remember asking my mom, like, how will those kids go to school? And she explained to me, school is not a priority right now. Surviving is a priority. They need food. They need shelter. And it just blew my mind that children could be without things that I just had every day. And that was my first, I think, awakening of realization, like, people aren't always born equal or have equitable rights and access to resources. So I gave a speech to my school after my mom spoke with the principal, after I showed great concern, and we wound up getting enough donations to fill a bus, and then we were able to get a plane that took the donations down there. So then throughout my youth and childhood, I continued to, like, my mom engaged me with, like, volunteering and showing up to communities who needed help in the local area. My dad was an international cargo pilot, and I learned that a lot of his work was actually delivering aid to other countries. His last shipments before retirement were COVID vaccines. And then I was also just always so interested in writing. I loved creative writing. I really loved telling stories. And then in college, it diverted to journalism because I thought, okay, in this post 9/11 world, 9/11 happened when I was in middle school. I was very much aware of how then geopolitical stuff was influencing all of our conversations in society, and how there was a sudden start to be rise of tension and misinformation and us versus them mentality. So then I turned my creative writing into journalism, where I wanted to really search for truth in things and be very much like fact forward in all of my presentations. And then in college, I studied journalism a lot. I studied Japanese culture and art and music. I went to a college that had a lot of Japanese programs and a lot of friends interested in that culture aspects as well. And I wound up going to Japan after college and working in journalism. And that was kind of another moment for me when I realized, like, oh, I'm getting to do travel and talk about now post 2011 tsunami and effects in the rebuilding in Japan, and talk about how this is meaningful for the globe and people all around. And when we moved to Virginia and experienced the Unite the Right rally firsthand, and I was reporting on that, it took me back to my childhood of like, I don't want to just watch this stuff on TV. I don't want to just film this or photograph this. I want to do something. So then I literally turned around and thought, well, how can I do something? And then I tied in my writing communications, and my ultimate aha moment was combining all these things and going into writing for nonprofits. So now I tell stories about the beneficiaries and the communities in crisis to help get call to actions and rally people to help change lives and make a difference in the world. And now I work for an NGO that uses aviation to transport aid. So it's kind of come full circle of telling stories, being abroad, and having all these aha moments that's now hit this point of like, okay, I'm doing exactly what I want to do now.
I love that. You're just tremendous. So tell us about your day job, because that's really cool. The day job you had when we met, so Natalie and I met at the National Press Club. We were both members. Natalie got to be really good friends with my daughter, Anna Gibbs, who's a photographer and videographer, who's done a ton of photos for Natalie, which are spectacular. And so now you had a job and now you have a new job. Tell us a little bit about that work.
So my previous work was with the Combined Federal Campaign. It's a 65-year federal campaign where federal employees used to raise money all by themselves, without matching programs, and they would donate millions of dollars every year to charities around the world. Actually, if they were a private organization, they would have been one of the top three most generous organizations out there. But since it was, federal, it wasn't tracked the same way. And I think over time, I think it's now $8 billion that federal employees have given. So it's really, there are a lot of unsung heroes there. And that was really cool to get to interact with thousands of charities, fundraise on behalf of them, and tell their stories. And now I focus my attention on Airlink, where I'm now their marketing director, and my day-to-day is creating this narrative in which we're taking all these stats of deliveries that we make, talk about the situation of these disasters, whether it's conflict or natural, and why the aid is important to get there, how fast we can get it there, how we're doing it, and the logistics and challenges we're overcoming. We were the first NGO to get into Myanmar after the recent earthquake a month or two ago. We are still housing things in shipment storage areas around Gaza, trying to move things in. We're creating air bridges to overcome challenging port closures to get aid into Sudan. It's really incredible all the work that is going on. So there's stuff going on every day. There's long-term protracted crises, there's rapid crises, and we're right there in the middle of all of it, getting these airlines to partner with NGOs and deliver this aid. So my job is making sure that the airlines know what's going on, our donors know what's going on, and everyone is all together helping in kind of like a swarm intelligence where we're all having a little piece of it and we're all trying to create this web of, okay, now the dominoes are falling. This is how we operate. So it's telling that story and getting people to take action right at the right time.
Well, as you know, part of the Empower Together Network, which is what we're doing this video for, video and podcast, because we're bringing, the whole idea is that we are calm, compassionate, calm, cool, compassionate change makers who are pining for the future we wish to see. And P is that promotion, which is what this is. We're promoting all of our members. We're inspiring. We're networking, connecting everybody, and we're educating. And, you have so much to teach, and that's a big part of this, where everybody has the opportunity to come in. All of our members can teach each other, which I think is so important. So talk a little bit about the political climate right now and the work you're doing with the closing of USAID and just all of it. Like, give us some perspective from Airlink.
So Airlink is in a fortunate position in which I think less than 10% of our budget was affected by USAID, and it was actually primarily in Latin America and the Caribbean, for hurricane season, interestingly enough, which hurricane season also greatly affects, of course, the United States. We just had record hurricane season. We're anticipating an earlier hurricane season than ever before. So we did experience a little bit of a budget kind of interruption. However, a lot of our partners we're finding are stepping up. So we are really cherishing and fostering those relationships with our very key partners who are committed to helping us directly. So there is a shift across the fundraising landscape now where the private sector companies and corporate sponsors will be looking for more local or direct contact as opposed to going to larger grants, foundations, or places where the money kind of goes through someone else. They're starting to give directly to NGOs like ours. And with so many of our partners suffering from much greater losses and effects by the USAID closing and limited federal funding, they're actually going to need a lot more help from NGOs like us who are in more fortunate positions. So we're actually looking to broaden our network right now and see how much more we can step up and what avenues we can help out more, because it's actually not just happening here in the US, partly because of the USAID decision. There are some other nations around the world and communities and unions are looking to do similar things. There's talks right now in the EU about their own funding. We just saw the news here on May 8th yesterday about Bill Gates in 20 years will be closing his foundation. So there is definitely a huge shift in the humanitarian sector right now. And a lot of private companies are going to be looking at now what their role is and how they can empower communities directly or with NGOs who can act as that grassroots operation that connects them right to the where the need is.
Cool unintended consequence. I love this. because when there's a will, there's a way, and the power of people never ceases to overwhelm me with joy. I turned one of our magazines, Being Candescent, into the Power to the People project. Until something shifts, or as things shift, what does it mean to be in a democracy and be in America in 2025 and moving forward? I think that's a big question for us all to answer, and your work is clearly part of the solution. And
No,
then, go ahead.
I was going to say that, Americans were some of the first to make charitable organizations and some of the first charities. So America and the United States have always been a charitable nation, kind of leading that. So it is interesting now to see the United States at the federal level step back, but companies always have that. They do remember this. It's very ingrained in American society to give back when possible. It's kind of a new concept in other countries. So I do think and hope that we will be resilient in the sense that we will keep coming together for the greater good.
Yeah, I think so long as there's food in the markets, if that's a question, right? And the safety of the food chain and the safety of quality and consumer protection there. I mean, pick a string and pull on it, and it feels like the sky is falling. I try and share a lot of those stories on our network and also on my LinkedIn page, just because I want a historic record of this, and I get thousands of impressions a week because I think other people don't want to look, but they want to know. So it's how you, what you're doing and how we can all make these small contributions. And speaking of historical accuracy, tell us about Ghost Train, because tell us what history, we're dancing, how it came about and what we can learn from it today, because it's, back to the future. So.
A little bit, right? Rewinding back to college when I was taking those Japanese history classes and film classes, and I was studying just early art back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and how it was becoming emerging that Japan was now a fixation on world culture. Like people wanted to know about this country that had been isolated for 300 years and had a new emperor and was finally opening up to industrialization. It was slower at first than the rest of the world, but it picked up really quickly. And it was a fascinating look at a culture that in one generation truly evolved and beyond its means and expectations. It had gone from complete almost medieval era to exceeding the United States and Europe in terms of technological advancement in just a couple decades. So my book, Ghost Train, is set in 1877 Japan at this pivotal time when trains are first being established in Japan, and there's routes to make now a whole lot of travel, supply chain, trade, everything a whole lot faster and more efficient. But because there wasn't as much news back then, a lot of these technological advances were a surprise to citizens, trains included. It really disrupted a lot of society. It created a lot of fear, a lot of tension, just like electricity did, a lot of Western medicine did. There was suddenly a whole upheaval in trust in one another. And what I observed in Japanese art was seeing foreigners as seen like almost demons, and we don't know what's coming. We don't know what's on the outside world. We're this island nation that doesn't understand the scope of the world, and finding its place in it, and knowing that the world is so infatuated suddenly with this mysterious country that it really almost was like a convoluted perspective. And so my book is about a young woman who is witnessing these societal changes and how she's also trying to figure out not only what's going on with her country, but going on with herself, because her family was of status. That status was removed in the sense that the emperor wanted to emulate the West and be equal to all. But of course, it meant men, not women. So she actually wound up losing more rights than she started with. And so she's now having to work. She's trying to figure out who she is in this society. And it starts to create these semi-delusions. It's exploring a metaphor of what's real, what's not, who do you trust, who do you not trust. And so there's a lot of Japanese folklore which represents the tension between modern Japan and traditional Japan, which came to a head around this time when the trains were introduced, and it was truly seen as a symbol of Japan is a powerhouse nation. We're going to succeed the West, and we're going to come together. It had been a splinter nation, so it was the rise of nationalism, and it was the rise of standardization across the culture. And it's interesting because when I was writing it initially, it was during the COVID-19 pandemic, and in 1877, there was a huge cholera outbreak, and they had to burn houses, they had to forego traditional funerals. So there was a little bit of parallel. And then, of course, with the way that everyone was trying to become unified, that gave me also a sense of some of the changes that we're seeing in American society too, of people trying to almost even out the playing field in more ways than one. And it was just this parallel of like, wow, history really does kind of repeat itself, and there's always going to be a victim of some kind. And I found a lot of connection to the young woman in the book and was able to pull out from my own experiences in both modern days and throughout other aspects of history, what women go through time and time again.
Yeah. And tell us too about how the history of that era and what you write about is true today.
So it is a pretty researched book. So it is based on true events that happened back then in 1877 Japan. And it's interesting that I find parallels in the sense that we're still a world full of tension and still trying to use technology almost as a one up to one another. And we're still very much afraid of one another too at the same time. And they use folklore as a way to explain things that they don't understand. And today, we use memes and misinformation to fill in gaps. So it's almost like we're creating our own folklore today too. So there's a lot of sometimes cover up where the leader, the emperor back then was trying to create their own narrative and create their own perception of what was going on in the world, and the people didn't know what to trust and who to trust. And today we're seeing that too take shape, both in the United States and around the world, where there's trying to be a control of media and this perception of what's happening. And so it's a change, it's a societal change, and it's very interesting to see how it's also, we're seeing an upheaval as well in our own communication today.
Yeah, for sure. So, given all you've studied, all you've experienced in not a whole lot of decades, how old are you now?
35
Okay.
for a while. I was like, how?
I know, I forget to. So what do you see coming? What's your forecast?
That's a big question. I'm trying to. I know that after November, a lot of things got very. Everyone was feeling on edge. From my perspective, I'm looking through history and I always see resilience. Things, sometimes feel like they get worse and worse and worse before they get better. I don't know what phase of worse we are in, because that's measured differently between different groups of people. Not everyone is seeing it that way. What I see is there is always an opportunity to look for the good. And right now, the good is found in your community. It's found in empowering one another. It's found in teaching one another those different tools and different things that you can learn now. Whether it's even something like another language, something that can open your mind and your heart a little bit more to another people or develop another skill. Languages are tough. It's tough for me. So something like I want to learn in the next, couple of years is actually like CPR or like stop the bleed, like some emergency things. You just never know. But I also want to learn some other practical skills for community building. And what I'm finding with my work as a humanitarian and with NGO is that we're not in competition. We are truly opening up a lot more communication avenues. We're having a lot more meetings between different team members to really share information and problem solve together. And you're going to have skills that your neighbor might not, and they might know something you don't. So strike up conversations in unusual places. You might bridge over these gaps that we're seeing that are creating this tension, and maybe we can work to heal just one thing at a time because everything is overwhelming. It feels daunting, but if you just focus on small, minute things in your community and in your home or in your world or your sector, then you will find opportunities to make good and feel better about your place in it.
Yeah, I love that. Yes, that is great advice. Absolutely. We just have to do it. and so I want to go back for our last question to the magic that your mom made in your life when she obviously realized that she had this spectacular child on her hands and she wanted to support you. So what can parents do? Because Incandescent Kids is our next big project here at Incandescent, where we're teaching kids to think like reporters, write, whether it's journalism, actively writing articles or illustration or video or all the things where we're telling stories. So what can you do? What advice do you have for parents so that they can encourage their kids the way yours did your?
So my parents were a little bit more unusual, and I realized that I also grew up in probably maybe a more fortunate, privileged position than a lot of people do. But I do think that there are some things that we could implement that are maybe easier than others to replicate. And I think, for example, my mom gave me and my sister like one of those maps from like AARP or Doctors Without Borders, like one of those free ones that you get in the mail, and we hung it up, and every day she would, or every week, something like that, she would have us point to a country to ask about it. And we would open up a dictionary or a thesaurus or encyclopedia, and we would just learn and read about it. Like, where was it? What was even the climate? What was the general history of it? So that was a very easy early way for me to start to see the world around me and what was going on and learn about other lives. Another thing was, even though it's difficult, and I know a lot of people are resistant to watching the news, watching the evening world news was something my parents had me do every day. So I was allowed like, I think half an hour or an hour of cartoons. So I watched like Arthur or Zoom, old Zoom back in the day on PBS, and then world news. So that was a daily kind of ritual. And then my parents were always with us, so we could ask questions. And I realized that, maybe people have different situations where parents are working double jobs or there's babysitters, but having time at least once a week to have open conversation, catch children up and let them know of these things that are going on, being candid will get them to ask questions and create them a more curious individual. I think encouraging children to be curious as opposed to avoiding topics or sheltering them, thinking that that's better, is going to make it tougher for them later on to connect with and be compassionate towards others. So those were two integral things that I think that they subtly did that really helped me a lot with that awareness.
Yeah, well, it's incredible. It's incredible what you've accomplished and who you are. Ghost Train, everybody go get a copy. It's fantastic. It's and there's more, right? This is just the first that you have a trilogy in your head.
Yeah, I do have two others written. Waiting a little bit to see how sales go, and maybe working on audiobook. But I am working on another book right now that's contemporary fiction. It's again, usually I'm more about historical fiction and making connections to contemporary life, but right now I'm working on contemporary fiction that's set in Oregon during some of the most recent worst wildfires in history, and it's about how a lot of state prisoners were actually voluntold to go fight the fires for no pay or really any commiserate like experience or support at all. And how they also put their lives on the line when maybe, it's a whole conversation. Do they deserve that? Who should be fighting these fires? And how do we treat prisoners? And how do we treat the environment? And so it's a look at that whole system that is really not looked at very often.
Natalie, you always have another great idea, something that is getting to the core of the onion, right? You peel it
Right.
back, but you're going for it.
We'll find Godzilla in there somewhere.
I love it. I love it. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Natalie Jacobson, author of Ghost Train and so very many things. Look her up, check out her website, and be sure to follow her. She is a change maker. All right. Thank you so much. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs with Incandescent. We look forward to talking to you again on the Empowered Together show. Check us out, incandescentwomen.com, and join us. It's only $150 a year, and you get an interview like this, and we're gonna change the world together. All right, we'll see y'all soon.